Mr. Gerald Adler, March 21st, 1985. Okay, so you were telling me about Volkov.
Yeah. All right. Now, the last thing I think I mentioned, that the SS went crazy whenever there was something going on the front lines, and we noticed that towards the end of the war, it happened more often and more often. We were punished by long working hours or by having to stand in formation for hours for no reason. And then found out afterwards that something happened. Somebody was killed with the Nazis, or some town was taken by the Russians, or the Americans had come closer. Something happened. But the behavior did not change. That's the funny part. You would have thought that maybe they would change and then become a little more humane and then try to save their hides that way. No, on the contrary, the closer it came to the end of the war, and they must have known also that the war was lost, the more bestial they became. And it was like a crazy dog, you know, that instead of getting better, gets worse. And with very few exceptions, they were really like animals, behaved like animals.
Was everyone that was guarding you German?
Let's put it this way. The higher-ups in the SS were Austrian. The immediate guards that were stationed around the camp were Germans. Until the end of the war, they all of a sudden sent us some Hungarians and Romanians, mostly men with one leg, one arm, people that were not useful to serve as soldiers anyways. And he had all kinds of difficulties even with those people, because they were volunteers for Germany. But the guards were not bad, because their duty was to keep us from escaping. But they had really no direct contact with us. They stood around in the perimeter of the camp, and that was it. It was the officers that gave commands and came down into the camp and did all kinds of little nasty little things.
Were they ever civil to you?
I remember one time, stands out in my mind because it's so grotesque. I was on a crew, and there was a lot of make work involved, let's put it this way. Because if that project would have been finished, the SS would have also been finished, probably sent somewhere to Russia to fight the war. They knew it, and they made all kinds of little pieces that would keep on going there. Anyway, we had to clean up the countryside there. We were in the middle of the woods, and one of the tasks of my group was to carry trees and put them all on one pile. And somehow or other, one of the trees slipped out of our hands and landed on a foot of mine, and I wrenched my foot. And one of the lower officers of the SS happened to see it. And he took me out of the work party and he took me home to my barracks and he gave orders to let me rest in bed until the next day. And because it was so completely uncharacteristic, it sticks to my mind. There were some that, while they were not really friendly, they were correct in their behavior, you know? But most of them had pleasure in somehow making life miserable.
Did you have any contact with your family at this time?
Yes. My family was allowed to send me packages once in a while. But the packages were useless because transportation was bad as it was during the war. And on top of this, the powers that be there made it a habit to let these packages sit for weeks without distributing. And most of the packages had some sort of food item in there, bread or whatever, which was spoiled. I mean, if you ever want to see green bread, that was green bread. So, but I knew at least I saw my father's and my mother's handwriting on the package addressed to me. So I knew they were still alive in the mound. But that was all, no mail.
Okay, so you mentioned that you were building barracks there?
Yeah, it was like a small town barracks, self-sufficient, had its own generating station. It was all prefabricated. Actually, all we had to do is put them together and paint them and put electricity in and stuff like this. But I don't know. It really came to nothing. It sounds ridiculous now. But I remember a big row that the head of the whole camp there had, the top Nazi, had with the painters, because the shade of the rooms was lighter or darker than he wanted. And he made them paint those rooms over and over and over again. And I don't even remember whether they ever came out to the shade he wanted. How often did he find little faults like this? But like I said, it was like a make work, you know?
How many people would you say were at Volkow?
At Volkow we were about 200, maybe 250. Most of the older ones were professionals, carpenters, masons, a few engineers, some electricians, and the younger ones were used for manual labor. And my job, I had actually two jobs. I was permitted to mix mortar. Now that is a job that you really don't want, because especially on days when there was no laying of bricks, you mix the mortar and you keep it soft with your instrument, whatever you have with tools, all day long. It's like stirring a pot all day long. Nobody comes, brings anything, takes anything. It was terrible. And then I became an expert on manufacturing barbed wire fences. wire came in single strands, and we had to run them between poles and then go up every so many inches apart. Every piece had to be straight, and sometimes you worked on the same section for 3 days just trying to straighten out so it looked good. Interesting job, too.
Okay, you mentioned that you were from an Orthodox background.
Yeah.
Do you think religion helped you get through it at any time? Did you ever pray?
Yes.
Were there ever any kind of secret prayers?
Yeah. Yeah, there were. Now, I don't tell this to many people. Probably it'll go out now into the world. I believe in the power of prayer, especially ever since that. I remember 1 year in Wilco. Of course, we never knew the date of a particular day, because we worked 7 days a week. We knew if the weather was cold, it was winter, and when it was hot, it was summer. But we had no idea what month it was. Anyway, we somehow figured out when September was, or October, I don't remember anymore. And there was people there of religious background. We got together and we tried to figure out when Rosh Hashanah was that particular day, year. And somehow we started watching the moon. And I still have it. I have a little pocket prayer book, which I was able to conceal in my shoe. I had all through the camps with me. And I said prayer. And from the time when Rosh Hashanah was, we counted 10 days, and we declared that Yom Kippur. Whether it really was or not, it really didn't matter. We declared it Yom Kippur. And that day, I managed to take that prayer book in my shoe out to my workplace. Slipped away in the morning for 10 minutes. I said a few prayers. That day, out of nastiness, we got a very sumptuous lunch. Food that we hadn't seen in years. And I got my lunch, but I didn't eat it. And kept it until the night. And when we got home, there was a group of SS men at the gate when body searches started. And anybody that had food on them, they dumped the food. But they passed me by. I had the food in the container hidden under my coat. I wore a coat and I had it. Carried it with my hand in my pocket and held on to it. They did not catch me. Somehow I got passed by in the body search. I was able to get that food into the camp. And that night, after darkness, was the first time in 3 years that I didn't go to bed hungry. Because I had lunch, and then I had my ration of dinner. And it so happened that night was the night when we got our bread ration for the next 3 days. So I had bread. And I did say prayers by heart very often. And I believe part of that is why I escaped that. Or even I believe very strongly in the power of prayer. But I know other people, again, who you are probably more religious than I. Rabbi is a teacher who perished. So who is to say? You know?
Mm-hmm. No, no one can say. Was there anyone who served sort of as a leader figure for the people either to raise inside Orville?
Theresienstadt, you had quite a number of rabbis from all over Germany and Czechoslovakia, I think even some from Austria. And I would say every square or so had a little prayer group, little congregation served by a rabbi, as long as there were enough rabbis. Maybe you could call these leaders. But you must understand that not all Jews in Theresienstadt were religious. So I couldn't say really. The only hope was to stay alive. Somehow to get out of this without harm. And not knowing about the gas chamber made it a little easier, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Wilco definitely there was no spiritual leader. And there was no need for one, because we were maybe one step higher than animals. You should have seen them. Dirty, ragged clothing. I remember I had a suit. Remember, we never were issued any clothing. Whatever we wore, we brought along when we were arrested first. So I had a suit, and somehow during one winter evening I got too close to a potbelly stove and the suit caught fire, my pant leg, and I found a big hole just above the knee into the pant leg of the suit, and I wore that suit until I came back to the living study. And my shoes gave out. We had somebody in the camp who would make a outline of your foot on a piece of wood and cut a wooden sole. And any piece of clothing you had, he would, even a piece of carpet sometimes, if you were lucky to have a bag, carpet bag, he would make a shoe out of it, you know, things like that. But you were closer to animals than human beings, also mentally.
So do you think you ever questioned the meaning of life at that time, or whether or not there was a God?
No. Didn't even think of that. Meaning of life. We only knew we wanted to live. That was the only meaning life had to us. Revenge came in. The idea of revenge became, towards the end, when we saw already those other prisoners being marched into Theresienstadt, when we heard what went outside. When I came back from Wulko to Theresienstadt, they pushed us on trains. We changed trains quite often because the railroad system through Germany was already very well destroyed. So to get us back, it took us 13 days. We traveled through almost all of Germany on a very circuitous route. And we saw destruction of towns and cities. We knew what's coming up. then the idea not only of wanting to live until the end, because we knew the end was close, but the idea of revenge started coming up. And we made mental notes of names and who we wanted to pay for what. Never worked out. Because those people, Theresienstadt in, I think it was in April of 1945, was taken over by the Swiss Red Cross. The Germans made a deal. And the Nazis disappeared and the Swiss took over administration. So anybody that was connected with the camp, and even in Volkow, once we were delivered back into Theresienstadt, those Nazis disappeared. Where to, we don't know. All we could do after the war, give the Allied people names. But we had very often no idea where they came from, what happened to them. Very often we couldn't even give ages, you know. So revenge was something very sweet in our mind, but didn't work.
So exactly when were you liberated?
The 9th, no, 11th of May. 11th of May. We were the last camp, Theresienstadt was the last camp that was liberated. The Americans stopped advancing into Czechoslovakia and left it to the Russians. And the Russians came the night from the 9th, from the 10th to the 11th of May, 1945. We were waiting for them for days, because we knew they had taken Prague, and we saw some bombing attacks on some of the surrounding towns around Theresienstadt. We knew there was fighting going on, we could hear it. But they took their good old time. That was the end. Actually, the end came when the Swiss took over, you know. They came with a caravan of 10-wheelers. Food and medication and doctors. God knows what they expected. I mean, still was a ghetto, it wasn't a concentration camp, you know.
How long would you say it took for you to recuperate physically? Where did you recuperate?
We stayed in Theresienstadt from beginning of May as free people until I think our transport left in July 45, end of July I think it was. We went back into Germany to the DP camp. First of all, all the Czechs were repatriated, the Hungarians. For the German Jews, if you wanted to go back to the town where you came from, they didn't put anything into your way. But the idea of DP camps was created a little later. And my folks had no desire to go back to Berlin. We wanted to get out of Germany as fast as possible. We had already contact right after the war with my uncle who was here in America. So American soldiers that came to Theresienstadt to look for relatives. And they would take mail along. He would ride, he would send us small packages through soldiers. So we knew we would get out of Germany as soon as immigration to America would commence, which was in 1946. But recuperate, it came very gradual, let's put it this way. The Russians were very wise. They didn't overfeed us in the beginning. They must have had a good experience with concentration camps and prisoners of war camps or whatever. And they gradually build up the food supply. Of course, we all of a sudden were fed food that we hadn't seen in many years. Fresh strawberries, cherries, and fresh vegetables instead of the German kraut that we would get once in a while. Meat, potatoes, you know, instead of margarine, butter would come in. You got fresh milk once in a while. And then something terrible happened in Dresden, a typhoid fever broke out. And among the prisoners from Auschwitz and from the others. And they closed off the ghetto. And they went from house to house every day. The team of Russian soldiers with a doctor combing through. Anybody who laid in bed and ran a fever was hauled off to a military hospital outside of Theresienstadt until they had that licked, and then they put together transports into the different countries. But by that time Czechoslovakia was already ruled by a Czech government. It was an autonomous country.
Okay, so when you went back to Theresienstadt from Vulko,
yeah,
you were reunited with your family.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about other family besides your immediate family? Did you ever hear anything?
No. Except for an uncle and an aunt from my mother's side who somehow were exchanged during the war out of, I think, Dachau, maybe Dachau, for German prisoners of war who were sent to Palestine. Those that were caught in the Nazi net perished. Nobody after the war came up anymore as a survivor. As far as we know, we were the only survivors of both my father's family and my mother's family, both large families.
When did you arrive in the United States?
That was May the 21st, 1946. Hotter than hell, but a glorious day. We were actually on the second ship to leave Germany, and only because there was no more room on the first one. My uncle had sent us an affidavit right away, and we were on the first list to leave Deggendorf to go to the American consulate in Nuremberg. From there we, as soon as transportation was arranged on one of those returning American boats, we got passage there. Yeah. I actually went, we were on the same ship as your great grandmother. I don't think you ever knew her, did you?
No.
Mrs. Blau's mother was an American citizen. And as an American citizen, she had preferential treatment. And she was on the same ship as we were. I don't remember her name anymore.
In the years immediately following your liberation, did you have any trouble finding a direction or purpose in life?
No. I think being together with the whole family, immediate family, is what helped. As a matter of fact, number one was to get to America, or get out of Germany, let's put it that way. Number two was to make a living. Number three was to continue my education, because I knew without at least the high school, which I never finished before the war, I wouldn't get anywhere. So there was never a question that you wouldn't go to work or you wouldn't go to school and you wouldn't help the family. You know? We all came with $5 board money, which the joint the distribution people in New York provided for everybody going tonight. We had that in our pocket, and whatever clothes we could get during the few months of the DP camp. So what was it? You had to start life anew.
Okay. There are times in life for all of us when we fail to succeed at something. When this happens in your life, who is to blame? Do you generally blame yourself?
Most
or circumstances?
Time. No, no. Mostly myself. Once in a while I say to myself, well, either it wasn't meant to be, or you got there at the wrong time, or it's late. But most of the time I say, well, a little more effort on your part and you might have succeeded more or whatever. I don't like to blame anybody else. Definitely not rather you would be.
Okay. Do you feel that persons like yourself have a chance of protecting their personal interests when they conflict with those of strong pressure groups?
Not as individuals, unless we can band together. We don't have a chance, because most of us are really not fighters. No. I think the closest I can come to man.
Okay. Do you feel that people are free to make their own choices, or are they restricted by those in power?
When it comes to everyday living, I guess you're pretty well on your own. But if it comes to an overall scheme, you're bound by the laws of the land, by how things are run, by the government and economics, and there are a hundred little other influences that either openly or even unbeknownst to you influence what you do. So you're not really a free agent.
Do you think most people share common ideas about what is right and what is wrong?
I often doubt it. I find myself, especially in these times now, I find that there are so many ideas of right and what is wrong, very often contrary to mine, that I sometimes believe either I got left behind by the time, or something else is wrong somewhere. But as far as morals and as far as ethics is concerned, I very often doubt that there is a unified hold of moral semantics anymore, even among religious people.
Do you think that as a Jew that you're isolated from the rest of society?
In certain ways, yes. I still feel like an outsider most of the time. And it might be a personal thing with me. I find it hard to make personal contact and establish relations with Montreal. I'm liable to see anti-Semitism where there might not be any. And very often feel rejected even if I should be. But it's more gut feeling than rational. I know it. But I guess it's part of my experience.
Do you think that as a concentration camp survivor, you're isolated from other Jews in any way?
Not the word concentration camp survivor. But I find that even in a congregation-like environment, there is an invisible barrier among the American-born, between the American-born and the so-called refugees, no matter from which country they come. As I grow older and more of the American people of my age group come into the same situation where their kids leave home and the congregation turns to younger people and they become pushed aside a little, I find myself, the bond grows a little stronger, but I found the separation until not too long ago rather marked. But it has nothing to do with being a survivor.
Okay. In your mind, do people generally care about each other or are they out for themselves?
Where do you get those questions?
General. I know, they're tough.
God. You're talking about generally. Couldn't answer that. I find people that I associate with and people I especially call my friends do care about each other. But then for everyone that cares about me, I can name five that couldn't give a hoot, and maybe I personally wouldn't care about either. So you can't generalize that.
Okay. Some people say to themselves, why bring children into a world that can allow atrocities such as those committed by the Nazis to take place? Do you or have you ever felt this way?
No, no. Even the atomic bomb threat hasn't really made me think twice about having a family. I believe that it's incumbent on us, first of all, as a Jew, to continue. Number two, we cannot really look into the future and see what's going to happen to our children. And number three, I think a lot of it is in God's hands. Well, that hasn't bothered.